One of the sweetest phrases to someone charged with a crime is when he is pronounced not guilty. That is what Jesus hears from Pilate three different times. Not guilty. I find no fault in him. And yet the trial continues. And more punishment is heaped upon Christ. I've not seen the movie, The Passion of the Christ. From what I hear, it is a very violent and bloody portrayal of Jesus' crucifixion. As we read the account of Jesus' trial and crucifixion, we quickly understand that Jesus' death was indeed very violent and very cruel. As Paul puts it, even the death of the cross. Jesus did not just die for us. He suffered for us. Even the cruel and the violent, the merciless death of the cross. But also his suffering was not just on the cross. From the Garden of Gethsemane to the halls of the Sanhedrin to the judgment hall of Pilate, Jesus suffered both physically and emotionally, spiritually, mentally, as Satan attacked him in every conceivable way. In John 18, Pilate has examined Jesus and found him not guilty. Not only is Pilate sure that Jesus is not seditious, he is not a rebel, but his wife has sent him a note stating that Christ is innocent and he shouldn't have anything to do with him. But the Jews and the chief priests and the leaders of the Jews keep insisting that Jesus be put to death. Now, Pilate is weak. Pilate is a coward. He wants to please the Jews and he wants to keep Caesar happy. And so in spite of determining that Jesus is innocent, he has Jesus scourged. Verse 1. Why would Pilate have an innocent man scourged? Well, it could be that Pilate thought that seeing Jesus beaten, the Jews would be satisfied and their hatred for Jesus mollified. It also could be that he thought that seeing Jesus beaten and mocked would be a demonstration of the impossibility of taking the charge of rebellion seriously. This Jesus was obviously not a powerful rebel leader, just a beaten loser. No one to worry about. Luke tells us that Pilate said, "I will therefore chastise him and release him." Now, the Romans administered three different types of scourging. For minor crimes, there was a simple whipping. It was a painful and shameful thing, but not debilitating. It not overly injurious, not deadly. For more severe offenses, there was a little harsher whipping. And then for those who were sentenced to death, those who were destined for crucifixion, there was a very painful scourging. They used a whip with several thongs on it, and at the end of each thong was either metal or bone tied to the end. And as the individual was whipped with this scourge, those pieces of metal and bone would tear at the flesh of the victim's back, even exposing bone. And the goal of this was to bring them as close to death as they could so that they would die quickly when hung upon the cross. About 100 years after Christ, a man by the name of Eusebius writes of certain martyrs during the time of Polycarp, who died, I believe, about 160 AD. He writes, "The martyrs were torn by scourges down to deep-seated veins and arteries, so that the hidden contents of the recesses of their bodies, their entrails and organs, were exposed to sight. As the metal and bone wrapped around the body and tore at the stomach." This scourging was so bad that it would not be performed upon Roman citizens. But after Pilate had declared Jesus innocent, this cruel scourging was administered to Christ. One of the complaints I often hear from inmates in jail is that they've not been treated justly. They've been overcharged, they're unjustly charged, and the courts have been unfair, when the truth is they are guilty and they deserve punishment. Our sin nature is such that we are very good at justifying our sin. In comparison to others, we walk with the angels. Even though God says we are sinners in every intent of our thoughts and of our hearts is only evil continually. But Christ was innocent. He was without sin. He was treated unjustly, even illegally and brutally, with malice and with spite, as he is despised and rejected by man, both religious man and political man. Christ was accused of being king of the Jews. So the soldiers thought that they would make him a king. And John tells us that they weaved a crown of thorns. This word crown is a word stephanon. The name Stephen comes from it. Now this was not a crown of gold. This was a crown of thorns woven into a circle. And this prickly crown with long sharp spikes was pressed down upon Christ's head. This crown of thorns takes us back to the Garden of Eden. Recall when God pronounced judgment upon the first Adam. He said, "Because you have heeded the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree of which I commanded you, saying, 'You shall not eat of it,' cursed is the ground for your sake. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you." Thorns, a result of sin, a sign of the curse, a sign of the judgment of sin, were weaved into a crown of mockery for the last Adam, who bore that symbol of the curse upon his head, even as he brought about deliverance from that curse. And as if that were not enough cruelty and mockery for this innocent man, they draped a purple robe upon his bloody shoulders, the mocking symbol of royalty, and they placed a reed in his hand like a royal scepter, and they began taunting him, "Hail, King of the Jews," while John tells us they were striking him with the palms of their hands. The Gospel of Mark adds, they knelt mockingly before Jesus and spat upon him as well. These were Roman soldiers, hardened, cruel. Some of this mockery perhaps may have been directed in the direction of the Jewish leaders, who apparently were observing. for there was no king of the Jews. They were a subjugated people. They lived under the yoke of Rome. And through this, these soldiers perhaps were also showing their contempt for the Jews that were insisting upon Jesus' death. Well, Pilate comes out to the crowd of Jews again, we're told, and he again declares that he has found Jesus innocent. And he brings Jesus outside again, beaten and bloody. He is draped in that royal robe of purple. He's crowned with thorns. He has a scepter made of reed in his hand. And Pilate says to the crowd of Jews, "Behold the man." He uses the word anthropos. Psalm 8 we read, "What is man that you are mindful of him? And the Son of Man that you visit him? For you have made him a little lower than the angels, and you have crowned him with glory and honor." And here is the man, crowned not with glory and honor, but disgrace and shame. It would seem that Pilate was saying, look at the spectacle of a man bloodied and humiliated and beaten. How can you think this man is a threat? He's had enough. Let's be done with it. And yet in his ignorance, Pilate is stating truth. Behold the man, here is the man. This man standing before you in humiliation was not only God incarnate, but perfect man. And here's another play on words. The first man was named Adam. Adam is a Hebrew word that means man. It was Adam, the first man, who brought sin into the world. And now Jesus, the last Adam, perfect, sinless, brings redemption into the world. Jesus, the man, in all the splendor and glory that God created man to be. Jesus was all that the first Adam failed to be, and so was, and still is, hated by fallen man. And the religious leaders, the chief priests, the officers responded to Pilate, not with pity, not with mercy, not with kindness, but with anger. It was not enough. Crucify him, crucify him. By the way, there is no him in the original text. It's just crucify, crucify. Also notice something interesting. It's not here the crowd that's crying for blood. It's the religious leaders. It's the chief priests and their officers. Pilate, with exasperation at his failure to be rid of this problem, acquiesces to the crowd and says, "I find no fault in him. But if you insist, go ahead, take him yourselves and crucify him." Now, throughout this account, Jesus is declared innocent again and again. When Judas saw what was going on, there was a degree of remorse, and he stated to the Jews, "I have sinned by betraying innocent blood." And they said to him, "What's that to us? You see to it." Pilate's wife, Claudia, wrote that Jesus was an innocent man, don't have anything to do with him. Pilate three times declares Christ innocent. King Herod found Jesus to be guiltless. The centurion who supervised Jesus' death upon the cross testified, "Surely this was a righteous man. This was the Son of God." But we need to understand that it was this very innocence that they hated. And they still hate. It is the enmity of the sinner against a holy and a righteous God. Christ's sinlessness, his virtue, his holiness, his grace brought not love and worship, but murderous hate from unregenerate sinners. And with Jesus bloodied and humbled before them, the Jews will not back down and reply, "We have a law. And according to our law, he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God." This tells us that the chief priests and the religious leaders understood totally, completely, and fully the claims of Jesus Christ. They knew that Jesus claimed to be God. But they rejected him. They rejected his claims. And they wanted him dead. They almost were too smart by half here. Their statement to Pilate got his attention and almost lost their case. You see, his wife's caution had concerned him. He now became, John says, even more afraid. The word is phobia in English. And now he is very fearful. The Jews were trying to strengthen their case and justify their desire for this miserable man to be put to death because he dared to make himself a son of God. But it caused Pilate to have second thoughts. You see, it was not Jesus' political actions that bothered him, but rather his religious claims. What did Pilate fear? Well, ultimately not the emperor and what he might think of him, or the Jews' displeasure, but what of the gods? If Jesus is a god, Pilate might be in real trouble. And so he goes back into the judgment hall and he asks Jesus, "Where are you from?" And Jesus will not answer. Now, John gives us no reason why Jesus is silent here. He's answered Pilate's questions before. He's interacted with Pilate and his examination. But now, this time, Jesus remains silent. "Where are you from?" John 1:1 tells us. But if Jesus told him, Pilate wouldn't believe him. Well, Pilate becomes irritated at Jesus for suddenly not talking to him and not responding to his questions. And so he asserts his authority. "Are you not speaking to me? Do you not know that I have power to crucify you? I have power to release you?" The word "me" in the first sentence or question is emphasized. Where is your respect for me? I have the power to give you life or to give you death. And Pilate puts an emphatic emphasis upon the word "power." And Jesus does respond to this. He says, you could have no power at all against me unless it had been given to you from above. Therefore, the one who delivered me to you has the greater sin. These are the final words that Jesus speaks to Pilate, at least that are recorded. And he plays off this word power that Pilate had emphasized. I have power. There are several Greek words that are translated power. We're probably most familiar with the one in English transliterated, for example, dynamic. Or we get dynamite. We find it in Romans 1:16. The gospel is the power, the dunamis of God. It's used of mighty works, intrinsic power, sometimes of ability. A less common word is kratos. Satan is said to have the power of death, Hebrews 2:14. And that word power of Satan is kratos. Plutocracy comes from this word. We might call this naked power, brute force, like Rome. Translated sometimes simply force or strength, might, manifest power. But the word that Pilate uses and the word that Jesus responds with is exousia. It's legitimate power. It is authority. So in Romans 13, the passage that deals with governmental authority, let every soul be subject to the governing authorities. And the word that is used there is exousia, power. For there is no power, no authority except from God. And the power or authority that exists are appointed by God. Jesus is recognizing that Pilate has legitimate authority. And Jesus respects that authority. He responds to Pilate with respect. But he goes on and reminds Pilate that this authority that he has is God-given. And it should not be abused. Pilate is not autonomous. He is accountable to God. Pilate's power is not inherent. It is not dunamis, but it is derived power. It is authority that is subject to God's oversight. Pilate does have lawful authority, and he should exercise it as one who is accountable. Now, Pilate is responsible. He is the governor, and in this case, the civil judge. But Jesus says that he does not bear all the responsibility. Caiaphas is the one who used his God-given authority to try to kill Jesus. Try to kill one he knew was innocent for his own personal advantage. So Jesus says Caiaphas has the greater sin. Now this doesn't exclude Pilate from guilt, does it? Because greater sin implies lesser sin. All sin is not equal. And Jesus says Caiaphas, with his religious knowledge and understanding, is of greater guilt. Jesus' answer seems to have affected Pilate. John tells us that from that moment on, he worked to free Jesus. But it raised immediate opposition from the Jews. If you're for Christ, you're against Caesar. It's Caesar or Christ, Pilate. You can't have both. There's no way to understand this response to Pilate than as a threat. If we don't get what we want, we're going to take tails to Caesar, and you won't look good. And it might very well cost Pilate his job. For Caesar would not look well upon someone who failed to punish an upstart rebellious king guilty of treason. Now there's a reason to believe that Pilate's conduct as governor wouldn't bear close scrutiny. He was a governor that took bribes and lined his own pocket, looked out for himself before he looked out for the emperor. In fact, the historian Philo wrote of him that he feared that if they actually sent an embassy, they would also expose the rest of his conduct as governor by stating in full the briberies, the insults, the outrages, the wanton injuries, the executions without trial, constantly repeated, the ceaseless and supremely grievous cruelty. Well, this might be a little bit over the top. You know, he's trying to make a case against Pilate. But Pilate's history was such that he could not bear a close audit from Rome. And so the threat from the Jewish leaders, the religious leaders, got his attention. And when he heard this threat, we're told that he immediately brought Jesus out again and sat down on the judgment seat. We're told that it was placed on the pavement. The meaning of this is uncertain, exactly what the word means. It may have been an area where there were rocks or bricks that had been set in kind of a mosaic pattern. But it would have been a courtyard area outside of the hall itself. The judgment seat was brought and set down there. And Pilate took his seat. The word judgment, of judgment seat here, is the word bema. You may have heard of that one. That you might recognize that. And there on the bema seat, Pilate passed judgment upon Christ. Someday there will be another bema seat. Romans 14:10 says, "We shall all stand before the bema seat of Christ, the judgment seat of Christ." Seated upon this judgment seat will not be a sinful man like Pilate, but rather the Son of Man, sinless, perfect, perfect in righteousness, perfect in his judgment. And Pilate, as well as all mankind, will stand before him. Well, Pilate, rather than pronouncing judgment as we would expect, announces, "Behold, your king." And they respond by crying out, "Away with him, away with him, crucify him." And Pilate says to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" And the chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." The Jewish mob does not like Pilate's conclusion, and they again demand that Jesus be crucified. The phrase "away with him" may mean more than they intend. It literally means to take up, as in lift him up upon the cross. Because Pilate responds, "You want me to crucify your king?" He seems to have understood it in that sense. And Pilate emphasizes "your king." He does that by placing "king" at the very beginning of his sentence, of his reply. To which they reply, "No, we have no king but Caesar." These chief priests, these religious leaders of the Jews, acknowledged the truth, the reality of their hearts. God was not their king. They paid homage to none but Caesar. Pilate, who's out of ideas, he doesn't know how to please the demands of the Jews without putting Jesus to death, whom he is certain is innocent, but he gives him up and turns him over to satisfy them to be crucified. What a clear example of the impossibility of serving two masters. Pilate could not both release the innocent Jesus and please the Jews. You cannot serve God as king and yourself or the world or your friends. Their demands are contrary. You must choose to serve either King Jesus or Caesar. And those who profess Christ are called upon by him to love the Lord God with all of your heart, with all of your mind, and with all of your strength. And that allows for no other love, no other king but Jesus. Is Jesus your king?